Hello and welcome, everyone. My name is Arezou Mohseni, and it's a great pleasure introducing tonight's program with Carol Walton and Ward Landrigan. We're here to celebrate the publication of Fashion for Jewels, 100 Years of Styles and Icons, with a discussion and book signing. The book is a brilliant story demonstrating how the world of fashion and jewelry have increasingly been integrated over the last century, and the emerging history of fashion and jewelry trends from the opening of Cartier's store in 1898 to the major influences of art, architecture, and cinema on jewelry design. Carol Walton is the jewelry editor of British Vogue and a leading international authority on jewelry. She's also a style commentator on the BBC and has written extensively on antique and contemporary jewelry for publications such as the Financial Times, the Daily Telegraph, and Spectator magazine. She works with several foundations, including the Arts Foundation and Royal College of Art, awarding prizes to young jewelers, craftsmen, and students. Celebrated jewelry expert and historian, CEO and chairman, Ward Landrigan is the co-owner of Verdura, along with his son, Nico Landrigan. His interest in jewelry began in high school, leading to his career at Sotheby's, where he became the head of the jewelry department at age 24. He first became aware of Verdura's work in 1965, and his offer to purchase the company was accepted in 1984. Today, he and his son continue to produce new products from Verdura's archive of 10,000 original designs, in addition to maintaining an estate jewelry collection. I'd like to thank our guests for attending in tonight's program. Copies of Fashion for Jewels are available for purchase and signing right after the Q&A session at the end of tonight's program. Also, I would like to bring to everyone's attention in this room the art and picture collections at Mid-Manhattan Library across Fifth Avenue from here, where you can freely browse one of the most accessible and comprehensive circulating collections containing over 40,000 books and videos covering every aspect of art, architecture, and design, and over 1 million pictures covering 12,000 subjects. Thank you all for your attendance, and now it's time to turn the floor to Carol Walton.
Hello, good evening, everyone. Sorry about that. Another little technical hitch resolved. I wrote this book because I think that ever since we've been wearing clothes, we've been adorning ourselves with embellishments for rings, earrings, necklaces, bracelets. But originally, jewelry was used as a sign of status and wealth. But I think that over the last 100 years, it's become increasingly known for its style. There's been a dynamic synergy in the worlds of fashion and jewelry, over which time they've become increasingly linked, as fine jewelers like Cartier, Boucheron, Chaumet found new fashion vocabulary to make jewelry part of a whole woman's image. It makes sense when you think about it, because there's a great shared heritage between couturiers and jewelers. And from the end of the 19th century, there were striking parallels between their work. They both share a savoir-faire, or what the French call their know-how. And the golden hands, the main d'or, who painstakingly create fine jewelry collections, use the same precise traditions as seamstresses and embroiderers around the Place Vendôme in Paris. One might be making frothy extravaganzas using crepe de chine and tulle and lace, whilst the other's using a much harder substance, ribbons of diamonds, tassels of precious stones, threads of metal. But they're both using the finest and most rare materials, superlative craftsmanship, and a shared spirit, really, of extravagant dreamlike quality. And this link was formally acknowledged this year, which was actually pretty fortunate timing for my book, because for the first time ever, the Fédération de la Couture in Paris put fine jewelry on the fashion agenda for the first time. So the jewelers showed jewelry at the same time as the couture in Paris. I think that the first step towards this happened in about 1898 when Louis Cartier, in a very sort of fashion-forward move, set up a store in the Rue de la Paix in Paris. And this was a street at the time which was burgeoning with perfume manufacturers, hat and glove makers. And he moves right next door to the House of Worth. And Charles Worth at the time was the most famous couturier. And so this gave them an opportunity for their shared clients to choreograph their entire look. And then in 1925, he chose to show his jewelry at the Exposition des Arts Décoratifs, which is the exhibition from which the term Art Deco took its name. And instead of showing his jewelry alongside the other jewelers in the Grand Palais, he chose to show it on mannequins in the Pavillon de l'Elegance, which no jeweler had done before, showing it alongside fashion. In the sort of 1930s, Coco Chanel was the first fashion designer to make a fine jewelry diamond collection. And she was so well known herself for wearing flamboyant jewelry, a lot of beautiful jewelry that she was given by some of her famous lovers, like the Duke of Westminster, which she had mixed with faux pearls and wear it all very happily together. So she imbued her diamond collection with a sense of flamboyance and style, which was previously only known in costume jewelry. And more recently, all fashion houses, so Louis Vuitton, Christian Dior, Versace, Gucci, have all shown now fine jewelry alongside their couture collections. Coco Chanel used to say that fashion isn't something which exists in dress only. Fashion is in the sky, in the street. Fashion has to do with ideas, the way we live, what is happening. And likewise, I think jewelry's never been made in isolation. It's always been influenced by what's happening around us. I think that jewelry design at its best is a distillation of the decorative arts of the period, whether it's sculpture, art, architecture, cinema. But I think possibly more than any of these, it's fashion that has made it change from being a symbol of wealth and status into a glittering must-have that most women wear every day. As we wrote in Vogue recently, diamonds are the kind of thing that should be worn on the beach, in the bath, doing the weekend shop, having sex. Hip girls are pairing them with everything from combats to couture. So the great difference, of course, in jewelry and fashion is that fashion is very fast-paced, it is very ephemeral, whereas jewelry is an eternal embellishment. It is something that speaks of now. It should have all the influences of the current zeitgeist, but in something that is timeless. But I think that for every strong fashion, there has been an equally strong jewelry look. And in my book, I've identified a few of those. So I thought we'd just look at a couple of very different ones. I thought we'd start with the Belle Epoque, and then I've chosen to talk about a more modern look as well. So this is Princess Olga Paley, who you can see with her hourglass figure, swags of jewels. She really exemplifies the Belle Epoque style, which was the beautiful era, a luxurious lull of opulence and extravagance before the outbreak of the First World War. It was a time when, you know, so many of your famous Americans, the Vanderbilts or Astors, would travel to Paris, which of course at that point was the center of taste and fashion, to visit the House of Worth and of course Cartier next door. This is a beautiful Cartier bow knot brooch in platinum and old rose-cut diamonds, because the jewelers at the time were on an equally grand path as the couturiers, creating jewels with swags of ribbons, garlands of flowers, and elaborate tassels of diamonds, which was in fact called the garland style. This is a Cartier squirrel tiara with milligrain setting. The inspiration for these jewels came from Empress Eugenie of France, who had her jewelry reset in the style of Marie Antoinette, which used motifs from the 18th century, called the Versailles Code. And the rose and lily motifs were embroidered onto gowns using silver and gold thread. And in turn, the jewelers mimicked the techniques of the couturiers, using gossamer-thin threads of platinum to support dazzling webs of white diamonds and pearls. This is Queen Alexandra, who was really the style icon of the Belle Époque era. She followed, obviously, Queen Victoria, who had plunged Britain into mourning for 60 years. And when Queen Alexandra arrived, the world fell in love with her style of sort of shimmering pastels and lace and her very sort of opulent look. I found a description in a society magazine at the time which described her in 1900 visiting the theatre. Dressed in black mousseline de soie, a wide diamond collar supported against her throat, a collet necklace and a long chain of diamonds falling over the dress, and in the coiffure, an aigrette of diamond with osprey plume and diamond arrows. She really did make a dazzling appearance wherever she went. And I think that also describes how the Belle Époque women almost sort of had a sort of a swaying grandeur about them, with their slightly S-bend silhouettes, these lavish plumed aigrettes in their heads. They slightly sort of bobbed and swayed as they made their way through rooms. She was a great advocate for the choker, which was a style adopted 80 years later, of course, by Princess Diana. But her chokers were actually worn to cover a scar on her neck. And as the fashion and jewelry worlds took inspiration from each other, designers began stitching platinum and diamond scrolls and garlands onto black ribbons to be tied around the neck. And actually, Edward Degas followed the fashion trend, painting similar black velvet ribbons on his ballet dancers. This is a lily stomacher in platinum and old rose-cut diamonds. And you can see the very sort of awe-inspiring finesse of these delicacy, of these garland jewels. And of course, as I've already said about the sort of influences of what's happening at the time, this fashion was only made possible by a couple of important discoveries around the 1900. The first was a chemist in Paris who managed for the first time to make platinum. He found the melting point for platinum, so it was able to be malleable to set with stones which hadn't been possible before. So they could use it, as it's a very strong metal, it could be used in thinner quantities, making very delicate fringing, intricate scrolls, platinum beadwork, and that was what made it possible to have these diamond swags and collars of jewels. And of course, they wouldn't have had the diamonds if there hadn't been the important South African diamond mines found at the time, when a little boy stumbled across a shiny pebble and it turned out to be an 80-carat star of South Africa, which I think he traded for a couple of oxen and a few sheep, and was sold a bit later on for £25,000 to the Countess of Dudley. So I think that's the story of the South African early diamond finds. Part of the fun, actually, of doing this book was cross-referencing the styles now and some of the influences that you can see. This is a modern piece which I saw last year at the Basel Jewelry Fair by Stephen Webster, and I just think it has so much of the Belle Epoque influence and the scrolls around this black opal. And this is Nicole Kidman in the film Moulin Rouge, 2001 film, showing the high elongated neck covered in about 1,400 diamonds set into this piece. But it's very much the Belle Epoque style of the high collar giving the elongated neck. And this was her playing Satine in the film Moulin Rouge. And this is a piece, a modern piece by Boucheron called Satine, which is a large diamond set chandelier. It's from their Gaieté Parisienne collection, which again looks back to their Belle Epoque heritage. And this is a necklace called Louis, which was named after one of the dancers in the Moulin Rouge. So I sort of rather like the fact that some of these styles, you can look back and they're also current at the same time, as many designers look back at their heritage. The second fashion I was going to look at was the Gothic trend. So it's slightly different. This is sort of dark glamour. This is an Alexander McQueen haute goth look. It has cinched in waist, corsetry, all black with raven feathers. The goth style started in London in the 1980s in a nightclub called the Bat Cave, primarily as a backlash against the colourful disco fashion of the 1970s. The early icons of the style were bands like Susie and the Banshees and The Cure, whose music celebrated the dark, shadowy side of life with a great fascination for death. The look really requires dark, melancholic-looking crushed velvet skirts overlaid with lace, with Victorian-style tailcoats and ruffled Regency-style shirts. The designer Giles Deacon actually sent his models down the runway a couple of seasons ago with their heads wrapped in black veils, which he described as femme fatale in a gothic disco. It's a very androgynous look, actually. It's sort of for men and women, but girls keep their femininity with sort of sweetheart necklines, intricate satin panels, tailored jackets laced up with satin ribbons pulled through silver hoops, and accessorized with quite tough-looking accessories, sort of studded leather gloves, spiked wristbands. And this is a raven's head skull in enamel and silver by a young London designer called Philippa Holland, and it's typical of a sort of goth look translated into jewellery. The goths really took inspiration from Victorian writers like Edgar Allan Poe and Bram Stoker, who combined romance with horror, conjured up the ultimate goth style icon, which is the vampire. And I think the success of the recent films like Twilight and True Blood have made vampire chic quite fashionable again. When goths' jewelry they feature creatures, but usually they're nocturnal. They come out at night. They're diamond moths or bats with jeweled bodies and diamond set wings. And more recently, we've had quite a rash of creepy crawly creatures like the stag beetle. This is Russell Brand, who I think shows the goth look here with his long chains. Often these chains have a sort of religious iconography on them as well. Ricardo Tisci at Givenchy recently burnt crucifixes into cobwebby black lace knits, which were worn with crosses on heavy gold chains. And lots of dark stones, you can see dark black sapphires and dark diamonds. This is a cuff with ornate filigree work. And it's by Stephen Webster, and he draws inspiration from the Gothic or black letter style of calligraphy and printing with its dark, angular, and complex fonts. So this is a sort of called Wild Rose Cuff. You can see it's got rose cut diamonds, rose quartz, shimmering moonstones. But it has finger pricking thorns and spiky stems to keep it quite goth-like. This is a flying fish brooch from the Fly By Night collection. Again, you know, sort of dark, sinister, dark diamonds like this moth, but it somehow they keep their sort of femininity. I thought I'd show you a picture of Stephen Webster as well. Someone earlier thought it was Ward, and a few years ago, in his goth phase. Stephen Webster is a sort of king goth. He's obsessed by the age of Charles Dickens. He sports black leather, intricate silver necklaces, and I found this quote about him as well, which sums it up. From his artfully chaotic hair, two sapphire and diamonds twinkle in his ears. A trip of bracelets circle his wrists, and under the tautly fitted shirt is a belt with a buckle that looks like a Hell's Angel has mated with a goth nightclubber. And this is by Garrard in London. This is a Fire of London cuff, intricate dark stone set into black and gold and silver, knife-like edges typical of the goths. And I think if goths do use stones, it verges on a little touch of blood red rubies, red spinels, a little reference to blood. I think if I, although I've shown you two men in goth clothing, I think if I chose a style icon, a feminine style icon, it would be Angelina Jolie, who still attends the Oscars in a sort of Morticia Adams style with her long dark hair, long dark figure hugging black clothes. And early on, when she was a teenager, she actually practiced embalming and wanted to be a funeral director, so I think it's very in keeping with goth style. And in one of her marriages, she swapped vials of blood with her new husband, which they hung around her necks, which again I think was almost like sort of crimson pendants, goth style. This is a set of Victorian mourning jewels which were fashionable in the 19th century following the death of Prince Albert, which really makes an ideal fashion statement for goths because they're obviously associated with death and they are literally jet black, made from Whitby jet, which is a fossilized coal. And it was sculpted into lacy chokers and dark cameo brooches for women to coordinate with their black mourning clothes. And this is a modern carved black onyx ring by a French designer called Muriel Gratto, which I rather like because she almost seems to use the gargoyle faces from around the Parisian architecture. Sorry? That is... Goths are pretty anti-establishment, so they love religious symbolism for crucifixes, rosary beads, and ankhs, the Egyptian symbol for eternal life. This is one handcrafted by Theo Fennell in black enamel with an engraved rose gold for a trompe-l'oeil effect on a Gothic-style cross. He also makes quite showy tombstone-style crosses set with black diamonds and white diamonds. And in tune with Alexander McQueen's sort of fairy tale look that we looked at the beginning, the sort of black corseted fairy tulle dresses, he creates precious devils and fairies as well as golden dragons and griffins and rising phoenixes that you might imagine emerging from a fairy tale by the Brothers Grimm, which were written in obviously the Victorian time. So that is really two fashions that I thought slightly summed up the merging of the look for fashion and jewellery. In one of my other chapters in the cocktail section, I talk about Verdura. And we're very lucky to have Ward Landrigan here, who can describe it much more effectively than I can, as he's the sort of the authority as well as the worldwide expert on jewellery. And he can also talk a little about how the duo worked with Coco Chanel and their influences and how they inspired each other. So thank you.
I know nothing about cars.
Now you do.
Now I do. Have to turn on my microphone.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Carol. And I might add that I haven't finished reading her book, but it's really a survey of jewelry, pretty much one page per jeweler from the turn of the century till today. And my life is quite blinkered in the sense that we deal mostly with Verdura. We also own the name and the drawings of Suzanne Belperron, who's another jeweler. That's where my life is, but it's fascinating. And anyone interested in the history of jewelry and how it relates to modern style should look at Carol's book and think about buying it. Thank you for coming. I've been asked to talk about Verdura, as Carol said. He was born the year that Louis Cartier moved to the Rue de la Paix, 1898, in Palermo, Sicily. And was a duke, a proper duke, and as such had never worked. No one in the family worked, but he had the good fortune of meeting Chanel in his youth and then coming to Paris. Just a bit about me. I started out at Sotheby's in 1964, where I met my wife, and my son's in the back. I had the good fortune, and much more by default than by expertise, to become head of the jewelry department at Sotheby's, basically because they fired everybody else. And, it was one of those things where the old firm, Sotheby's, bought Park Burnett, which was the big New York auction house. And I had been to school in London, and also I was so new, I hadn't done anything wrong yet. And I was in the jewelry department. I had actually worked as a youth from the time I was 14 in a local jewelry store. My background was a blue-collar family out in New Jersey. I was born in Newark, and then as things changed, we moved out and ended up in Springfield. But I worked in the local jewelry store and became absolutely riveted with the idea of jewelry, mostly colored stones. And I think the thing that really fascinated me was design. Anyway, the first few years I was at Sotheby's, we had some amazing sales. And this was a stone that I sold to Elizabeth Taylor, which she still has. That's me 40 years ago with her in Wales. And then I sold her the big diamond, the 70 carat, which she subsequently sold. Anyway, I had this wonderful sort of boom start. And it was exciting for a kid from the suburbs. But I became interested in Verdura because I had the good fortune of seeing his jewelry come up for auction. And the thing that frustrated me, really, was the fact that no one ever wanted to sell it, because usually when they're selling jewelry, they're trying to raise money for taxes. And, you know, there'd be Harry Winston and Van Cleef and Cartier, and these were the really expensive pieces. And a lot of the Verdura pieces were custom-made, very often using so-called semi-precious stones, and not terribly valuable, so people would always... And also they were very personal because they were made for the special occasions. So people would say, well, I'll sell this, but I'll keep the Verdura, which drove me bananas because I wanted it. You know, it was the kind of thing you could put on the cover and people would get excited because it was fun and whimsical. Anyway, his background was very interesting. And in fact, I met Carol in Palermo. She was writing for Tatler then, and I'm thinking this is about 15 years ago. This is a picture of Verdura with the sailor hat and his family, taken in about 1910. This is the interior of the house where we did the show. Carol, you remember that? Yes? Yeah. Anyway, at the house, every square inch of it is decorated, as you can see. And it's also the mayor's residence in Palermo. So the mayor called us at home one morning. I think my wife remembers this. It was about 8:30 on a Saturday morning, and this man with a very, very heavy Italian accent, you know, said, "I'm the mayor of Palermo." And I thought it was a friend pulling my leg. And anyway, he said, you know, we're going to have you come to Palermo and do the show on the Verdura. And I said, oh, yeah, really? Anyway, the fact is I couldn't get insurance because Lloyd's didn't want to insure our jewelry in Palermo. This is when things were still pretty peppy in Palermo. And he said, oh, I'll talk to Lloyd's. And he did, and they insured it, which was wonderful. Anyway, he had contacts that I didn't have. Anyway, we had a 10-day exhibition that was quite remarkable. I'm going to jump ahead now. In 1919, Verdura was then 21 years old, and he was home recovering. He'd been shot in the war in his arm, and he was recuperating at home. And Cole Porter married Linda Porter, a much older woman who had lots of money, and he had just graduated from Yale. And they'd moved to Paris, and they were in Palermo on their honeymoon, and they met Verdura and liked him, and invited him up to their house in Venice. They had rented this marvelous Palazzo Rizzonico in Venice, and he came up for the weekend. And at the party, the weekend party, was a guest. Another guest was Coco Chanel. There's Verdura, and there's Chanel, and the remarkable thing was that, you know, she liked young men, and she liked young men with titles, so she invited him back to Paris, and he went. I took this picture. This is one of Chanel's concoctions when she was a milliner. But what's amazing is you think how women, as Carol said, changed from, this was about 1914, 1915, and then 10 years later, here she is. I mean, she basically reinvented the way women dress. And, I mean, the cuffs that she's wearing were designed by Verdura. They're probably the most iconic pieces he ever made. But he basically did this look, all the look of the layered pearls. The earrings are his. In fact, even the hat pin she's wearing is his. When he first started working for her, he went to work for her as a textile designer. But within 6 months, they became friends. He was escorting her to parties. And as Carol said, she had a wonderful collection of jewelry from her lovers, the Duke of Westminster, the Grand Duke Dmitry of Russia. These fellows had nice jewelry to give. The problem was this jewelry was basically Victorian or Edwardian, and it didn't really go with her look. So she and he traveled around Europe. This is the Queen Theodora in the... in Ravenna, in the chapel in Ravenna. But they got the idea for Byzantine gold and diamonds. And what's interesting to me is that basically gold jewelry with colored stones really hadn't been popular for about 20 years. It went all the way back to Victorian times. So gold was revolutionary, but it worked for Chanel because she wanted something she could wear in the daytime with her jewelry. And these were two of the earliest pieces that I could find that were actually made by Verdura for Chanel. And interestingly, supposedly made from her own stones, and even more interestingly, sold to Diana Vreeland. And I mean, what a coincidence that the lady who started the Costume Institute ended up with the two earliest pieces of Verdura for Chanel. And she wore them in her hat, and there she has them on her dress. And then they came up at auction recently at Christie's and brought $191,000, which was a lot of money, and I was bidding, but not that high. And then no one would tell me who bought them. And then when they had the Chanel show at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, there they were. The Chanel Museum bought them. So that's why I couldn't afford them. Anyway, these are the original cuffs that Verdura made for Chanel. And you can see what's interesting here is that these motifs are really very similar to the ones he put in the cuffs. And these were the cuffs that she always wore. She had them in different colors. And I chased these around for about 25 years, and I finally found them about 6-7 years ago, and I bought them. And I have them in my collection, so if you'd ever like to come up to Verdura, you can see the icons of Chanel. There they are. That's Verdura and Chanel examining the cuffs when he made them for her. And there she is, a typical picture of her. She obviously always wore them. Verdura came to America in 1934 with his friend Nicky de Gonsberg, and Nicky's the one on the bottom of the line, and Fulco Verdura is pointing on the top. And they made a trip around America in 1934 in a 1934 Packard, and they visited their friends and went up to Hollywood and generally had a very good time. Foucault came over at the request and suggestion of his friend Cole Porter, and very shortly thereafter got a job in New York working for Paul Flatow, and he became the head designer for Flatow. And this piece, those of you who are interested in Cole Porter probably know that there was a collection of cigarette cases that his wife Linda gave him for the opening night of every play and every movie that he did. And this one was the one that he did. This was for Red Hot and Blue, which Verdura designed. It was 1936. He was working for Flatow. The clever one here for Linda Porter just ordered it. The center section was a big diamond pin that she could wear when he wasn't using it as a cigarette case. So if any of you are looking for ideas for your husband, you can always think of a way to put something in there for yourself. Anyway, this was written up in Life magazine as the jewel of the year. And it was really around that time that Verdura's name was becoming well known in New York. In 1939, his boss, Paul Flatow, went to jail, got sent away for swapping his client's stones for fake ones. Anyway, so that was on a Friday, and on Monday, Verdura opened in the same location. So it was sort of a seamless transition, and the clients knew who was designing the jewelry, and the name just changed from Flatow to Verdura. The backers were Vincent Astor and Cole Porter. So what was wonderful for Verdura, each one of them sent their friends, and of course they came from different communities, but the Hollywood crowd came, the social crowd, the European crowd came through Porter, and then the old New York Society people came from Vincent Astor because they were looking after their own money as well. Anyway, when Cole wrote the song Night and Day, Verdura did it, made a present for him of this Night and Day dress set. And the little studs are dark blue enamel, and it's. And we have clients who, if they have houses in South America and here, we put little diamonds where they have their houses, just in case you have more than one house. This movie was called The Lovely, and it's. We did the jewelry for it, and it was good fun, but it was all about Cole Porter, and it was Ashley Judd and Kevin Kline. Anyway, I got to spend some time on the set, and it was fun. One of the iconic pieces that is really well known from Verdura's point of view is this the curb link bracelet, and he did that for Greta Garbo, and I still think she's one of the best-looking people that ever showed up, and it's something that it's, even though gold prices have gone up and the prices doubled in the last couple of years, it's still one of our most popular items. Here's another lady who has one on, and that was that's Slim Keith, and she was married to Howard Hawks and Lord Keith and others. This was something of hers as well. Now, as we get into the jewelry, I'm going to go rather quickly here. The thing about Verdura, when you see the jewelry, what amazed me when I bought the company is I didn't know how many designs there were, and as Carol said, they're just a hair under 10,000, I think 9,987 finished drawings. And what amazed me was that almost all of these pieces that he made, and I figure he made about half of the 10,000, they're mostly them, almost all of them were one of a kind. And that's a lot of one of a kind jewelry. And what's also interesting is that he had a very sort of eclectic taste. But it was really classic jewelry in the sense that they were found, his designs came from churches. This has come from the little, if you go to Italy, southern Italy particularly, you see the putto on the ceilings of the churches with the little wings sticking out of their heads. And you'll see all kinds of classic references. The other thing, his jewelry is not static. It has a lot of movement, and it's usually asymmetrical. That's Slim Keith again. But, I mean, that picture is taken in 1941. And what's amazing about a woman like that, it's just as modern today as it could be. Here's a very good-looking grandmother in New York, our friend who wears these and gave them to her daughter. But it's very rewarding to see Carolina and other modern women in the fashion business appreciate what we do. This rather beautiful man is called Tyrone Power, and he married this other beautiful person in 1939. And he commissioned for her in 1940 or 41 a Valentine's present. He actually, Carol put it on the cover of her book. Thank you very much. It's a wrapped heart. And he went to Verdura and he said, if I could give my my heart gift wrapped to my wife. That's what I'd like. And then that was that's the jewel. And that's part of our museum collection too, which is rather spectacular. Anyway, this is the Tyrone Power and Suzanne, I can't pronounce, Charpentier wedding. She was actually in the Abel Gance movie in 1927 of Napoleon, the five-hour classic. That was her first movie. Here's another ruby heart on Jerry Hall, courtesy of Mick. And anytime he got in trouble, we knew that he'd be buying a nice piece of jewelry. So we'd read all these stories in the newspaper and know that we had a good sale in the offing. There's Elle McPherson wearing one on a jeans jacket. The nice thing about this jewelry is it's light. I don't mean in weight, but it has whimsy. And at the same time, it's important, serious jewelry, but it doesn't have to be worn only to black tie occasions. He made it in other colors. This is one he did in about 1960 in yellow sapphires and gold. This piece he did in collaboration with Salvador Dali. In 1940 and 41, he did a whole series of jewels with Dali, which were, all I can say is they're very strange. This piece is about 5 inches in diameter, and it moves. It moves like that. It hangs and swings around. And I won't say any more, but it's quite something. And this piece, now we'll just start moving. In 1941, Verdura was written up in the profile in New Yorker magazine. And they said he was like a Renaissance jeweler because he loved these great big Baroque pearls, and he made interesting animals and characters and figures. And the diamond in this piece was given by a Maharaja to the second to the last Viceroy of India, Lord Curzon, and he left it to his daughter, and his daughter brought it into Verdura and said, "My father was Viceroy. I'd like something that would commemorate him having been Viceroy of India." So Verdura made this sweet little Indian elephant brooch, which was sold at Sotheby's in London, and I didn't get it. This is a rather wonderful, it's a Roman opal cameo head that he's turned into a warrior brooch, also pearl. He made a series of swans for the ladies Marella Agnelli, Babe Paley, there were four or five of them, because they all had very long necks, Gloria Guinness. And he made swan brooches for them. He also, in 1940, 41, he took an Indian chess set and jeweled them and made brooches out of them. This is my favorite. But what's fun is to use found objects, too, and you can see. This is what's left of the chess pieces. And then he's put the gold on the bottom. And this is a wonderful piece of jade and then three rubies, but quite unorthodox. This is a rather large ivory. I think he got it as a horse, and then he cut it in half. He loved unicorns, and he stuck the horn on top, made it into a unicorn. And then it's cut in half here so that the lady could take it off and wear it as a brooch. This is his Lily of the Valley brooch, and you have a piece in your book that's very similar to this. This particular one was made in about 1960, but the first one he did for one of the Rothschilds who brought her children's milk teeth into him, sounds disgusting, and said, "I'd really like a piece of jewelry I could wear, have my children's teeth on it." And he took the teeth and he covered the ugly bits, the root end, with the diamonds, and then hung it off and made a Lily of the Valley. And there's a significance to Lily of the Valley because on May Day in France, it's traditional to give your wife, daughter, mother, lover, friend, a muguet, a little brooch or real Lily of the Valley. This is a shell brooch that he made. I found this in Paris. These shells were they're found off the coast of Florida on the west coast, and they're called lion's paw. They're quite rare. And this piece was made in the 40s, and several famous women had one. This one was Tallulah Bankhead. You can see her wearing it at the décolleté. The most beautiful woman that owned one was Bismarck, Mona Bismarck, who was also Mona Williams. I think she had 5 husbands, and each time one died, she married up. She did very well. This is a sort of semi faux military order, but I mean it's obviously a Maltese cross, which was sort of Verdura's motif. This he made for Claire Booth Luce, who had two bracelets given to her by her husband, Henry, an emerald bracelet and a diamond bracelet, which she didn't like, so she brought it in and he converted them. This woman, Millicent Rogers, supposedly gave Verdura the idea for these sort of faux military orders. You can see she's actually wearing one there, which is a real military order. And these things, you know, people would get them and they'd sit in a drawer, and her idea was, why not wear them? They're fabulous. So, and then Verdura did a whole series of sort of these gemstones in different formats. This is actually, this is Annette de Laurentiis. It's a 50-carat black diamond that she was given for her wedding, iris brooch. And it's also, you can see that he did a lot of natural forms. This is a rose brooch that actually belongs to Ross Perot's wife, Margot. And, I mean, you know Ross Perot, he ran for president. But he seems like one of the least likely person ever to be collecting jewelry. And it turns out he started buying Verdura in the 50s for his mother. And this was one of the pieces he gave to his mother. This belongs to a rather wealthy farmer, and it's natural black pearls and yellow diamonds. This is just, you have to smile. I found this piece in Basel, and we had a friend who was living up in Newport, and she had a brown poodle named Fusspot. And I called her when I found it, and this is Verdura. I said, I found Fusspot. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, we actually found your poodle in black pearls and brown pearls. And she said, I'll take it. And he's still with her up in Newport. And these were great big brooches like this, worn on the outside on fur coats in the 40s, these nosegay brooches. This is about this big. It's diamonds. It's about 150 carats of diamonds. It's called white lilac. The pomegranate had significance, particularly in Palermo, because they grow there. But it also, it's a sign of good luck, and it's also a sign of fertility. Pine cone brooch, which is, again, I found that in Rome, and it was made for a family that had those wonderful umbrella pines. This is a rather large eggplant, aubergine. This piece was fun. I got a call one day from the Coney Island Aquarium, and they said, we have something interesting here with your name on it. And I'm going, what could it be? And they say, well, it's a very large clamshell that opens up, and inside is a mirror, and it's all fitted out as a compact. And I knew right away what it was, so I bought it, and it's in our museum. And there's a story, it may be apocryphal, but it's a nice one. There was a very wealthy woman out on the beach in Long Island who had her house along the in East Hampton, and her husband had been dead, and she apparently had an affair with a young man, I don't know, it's sort of the gardener or something, one summer. And he couldn't afford to give her anything, so he gave her the clamshell and you know, said to remember me. So she didn't want to forget him ever, so she brought it into Verdura and had it made into a compact. Why not, right? I'm just, you know, whimsical little fairies on snails. This is actually an interesting piece. It's a very heavy gold tiara. It's been in a couple of the important tiara shows around the world, and it was made for, it's made for her, and that's Betsy Whitney, and Jock was made ambassador to the court of St. James under Eisenhower, and traditionally, at the investiture, the queen, Elizabeth, takes the sword and puts it on his shoulder and announces that he's the new ambassador. Well, usually most people rent their tiaras from S.J. Phillips on Bond Street, but being Mrs. Whitney was a great friend of Verdura's and also had lots and lots of money, she commissioned Verdura to make an American Indian headdress. And apparently Queen Elizabeth had only been on the throne for 3 years, I think, at that time, and apparently it was well received. Anyway, and then just before she died, she came in and gave it to me as a present, which I said, Mrs. Whitney, I can't accept this. It's got 40 carats of diamonds in it. But I promised to put it in my museum where it lives happily. This was also Mrs. Whitney's. And when Verdura came to America, he was fascinated because particularly in Sicily, they don't have the changing colors. So he made a whole series of these wonderful autumn leaves. And James de Givenchy, who's another fine jeweler here in New York, worked for us for a few years. And he took me over to Christie's one day to introduce me to his uncle, Hubert. And we were walking around the exhibition, and there were one of these leaf brooches in the exhibition, and Hubert brought me over because he knew I was Verdura, and he said, this is my absolute favorite piece of Verdura. So it's nice to know what Hubert de Givenchy likes. This was done for Claire Booth Luce when she wrote the play The Women. And if you've ever seen the movie, actually, if you haven't, you should. 1941, I think the movie was done. And it, the play came out in 40, and she won the Tony Award, and she brought the Tony Award into Verdura and said she wanted it made into a brooch. Well, one, it's about that size, and two, it's very heavy. And he said, it's polar material. So anyway, she said, oh, I'm so sorry, et cetera, went home. And he told his friend and her friend, Betsy Whitney, about it. So Betsy commissioned this as a Christmas present for Mrs. Luce. And wrapped jewelry, I'll move right along now. You can see this is, everything is motion, nothing's static. Big diamond wings that flap. This was her diamond ring that she wore every day, and it's about 22 carat yellow diamond. And he had, Verdura made this for her in Paris. It's her compact. And this is her beehive watch, her pineapple, that's her pineapple watch because she had a house in Jamaica, the diamond kitty cat. This was actually designed for her in 1940, and it's one of our most popular rings. This was the first Mrs. Paley, the one that got deposed for Babe, but she also had amazing jewelry. And that was a trip that she and Bill took to South America, traveling around buying up radio stations. And when they were on the trip, well, this is a great ring that she had, and we still make this, and it's got 26 Luke stones in it, and they shake, and you can hear them rattle, and we make them in earrings. We make them in different colors. This necklace was a collection of emeralds that she brought back from South America and brought into Verdura and said, please make me something I can wear in the daytime. So he made his marvelous scarf necklace. For those of you who need an emerald necklace that's good for daytime. This was also Dorothy Paley, the first Mrs. Paley's. She had some loose stones, and he made this marvelous target brooch for her. And this is the end of it. When Verdura was getting ready to leave France, they had these marvelous parties, and he was an escort. That's him with Chanel. She's dressed up as Emperor Maximilian's wife, and I don't know what Verdura is, but... They used to go to these parties, and that's Verdura, that's Cole Porter. And these parties were like operas that had the backgrounds and sets by Picasso, music by Poulenc, and the parties would go on for 2 or 3 days. That's Verdura with Lady Wimborne, who looks zonked. That's him as Napoleon. This was the party that he gave where he literally blew his last bit of money. But it was such a success. This is 1929 in Palermo, and everybody came, the magazines, Vogue, they all came and wrote about it. That's him in Vogue in 1929 about his party. There he is with Tallulah, with Bill Paley on holiday in Venice, and that's the last slide of him at the end of his life, and I've probably taken too long, but thank you very much. It was great.
That was so interesting, Ward.
Oh, you're nice to say that.
I think it's quite interesting when designers start from in a different medium, whether it's costume jewelry or tapestry, like Joel Rosenthal in Jarre in Paris, or Verdura starting from another medium. I think. Do you think it gives them a more kind of creative, freer hand to design?
I'm thinking of other jewelers. Scaparelli started out, Schlumberger, because Schiaparelli had Schlumberger making buttons.
Yeah.
So, yes, I would say yes. That's a good point. Yeah. I mean, there aren't that many jewelers who start out in another field, I don't think. I don't know. I don't know the history of most of them.
I think quite a few started... like Schlumberger and costume jewelry, and I think it just, if they're not sort of overrun with the sort of the preciousness of what they're working with, they can be a little more irreverent with it, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And it's much more obvious, I think, in the modern pieces because they're less formal. Mm-hmm. And I think you made a point in your talk that I think as soon as the value of the piece is made less obvious, you know, people get hung up on the idea that, you know, diamonds are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars and rubies and emeralds and sapphires. But it's really about the design, and unless the mounting is nice and it sits well on the body, it's not a good jewel. No. I mean, the stone is good, but that doesn't make it a good jewel.
Yes, I think the design is really the blueprint of the jewel, isn't it? And, well, and you've, without that, without the design combined with the stone, it makes something with great power, I think, if you have the combination.
Webster's the piece I was thinking about. Them. I mean, like that wonderful goth cuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's got rose quartz and moonstone, and the diamonds aren't valuable, but it's a very effective piece.
Yes. I think the other thing I was thinking as I was listening to you is how we don't have so much patronage now. That the juror was very fortunate that he had so many women with such great wealth who were very interested, and they wanted to make jewels that really combined with what they were wearing or for particular occasions. And I think now there isn't that patronage. And I was thinking of that too last week in London when the Duchess of Windsor's one of her panther, her iconic panther jewels, an onyx and diamond bracelet, sold for £4.5 million. It was one bracelet. And I mean, it just wouldn't... Nobody would commission that now. Indeed, if it could be made at all.
I was going to say, if it could be made. Exactly, exactly. And I made a point about the one-of-a-kind jewelry. When I bought the company in 1985, we tried to do everything one-of-a-kind. Well, the problem is the development costs for making a piece are so great. By the time you actually have to factor that into the one piece, it makes it too expensive. I mean, it's priced well beyond what you can sell it for. And so you end up selling it for much less, and then consequently wouldn't be in business very long.
So do you think his cocktail years, as I called them in my book, that sort of kind of 30s, 40s, were the sort of great years?
For Verdure?
Yes.
Yeah, although I think he was still incredibly inventive right up to the time he retired in 73. But I think your point about patronage is important, because the great patrons were leaving. I mean, these incredibly wealthy people. You know, by the 50s, things had changed. I mean, Mrs. Astor... I remember she came in, she was 97 the last time she came in to buy an important pair of earrings, and I thought, boy, that's an optimist. Well, 97? Well, she enjoyed them. I mean, she lived to be 105. But it's true. Paul Mellon, who is also another one. In fact, Mr. Mellon, Verdure used to call him his patron. You know, and he was a patron of the arts, and he bought, you know, and they gave the museum in Washington the modern gallery.
I guess also working at that time, around the time of the war, when precious stone, diamonds, gold, metal was used in the war effort.
Right.
So he must have had to be slightly more inventive with actually what he worked with.
Yeah, that's true. Well, they worked, instead of platinum, they used palladium. Mm-hmm. And I know they used, here in this country, they used 14-karat gold. And, of course, in Europe, they weren't making anything. And the Europeans don't feel that 14-karat gold is even gold. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of compromise, I think, at the time.
And more colored stones and semi-precious stones than have been used before.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah. But I think he always liked color. I mean, partly being, you know, from Palermo. I mean, it's very, very Sicilian, the use of color.
And how important do you think his time with Chanel was at the beginning
of
his
career? Oh, I think that was incredibly important. I think that really launched his career. I mean, I tried to read as much as I could about her, and there isn't that much that relates really to what he did for her. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they stayed friends was interesting, because I gather a lot of times if you were close to her at one point, you know, she would sort of dismiss you. I think he was snarky enough, and I think he was very sarcastic, and she liked that. I mean, she liked to be, you know. I think she was quite the same way, but I mean, her sense of genius, and I think it really was genius, was her ability to adapt and change. You know, I mean, just the way she changed her style of clothes,
and her vision for a modern look.
Yeah, and the jewelry was revolutionary at the time. I mean, nobody was doing that kind of thing, the gold with the colored stones.
I mean, she put women into trousers that hadn't been done before.
Yeah.
Red lipstick. books and...
Yeah, and bobbing hair.
Bobbing hair.
And smoking in public was another one.
Matelot shirts.
Yeah, exactly. No, but it's really exciting. But I do think his time with her, he was with her for 8 years. That's a long time. And I guess he was really with her for 8 years because they used to go out in the evenings together too. But tell me about what's your next project? Come on.
I'm still just publicizing this one. Well, I think I might go further and look at what the sort of visual inspirations of designers.
Where it comes from.
Yes, and sort of follow their sort of visual inspiration from... I think there are quite a lot of designers who have sort of almost mood boards. They're sort of things that they see that inspire them, influence them, and their drawings and sketches and putting it all together and then seeing it come out into the sort of finished product and what has inspired them. I think it's quite interesting.
Oh, it is.
And I think, you know, there are a lot of people now taking many more risks. It's more fashion-led. So I think you get many more sort of avant-garde pieces really coming through.
Yeah, and they can afford to make it because it isn't necessarily made with this very, very precious material.
Yes.
What was your favorite period in the 20th century that you covered? If I could... You have to...
Well, doing what I do is seduced by many different eras. It's really difficult for me. I get sort of crushes on certain times. I have to say I'm slightly swayed by the tough look of the sort of real deco, that sort of machine age when they're sort of obsessed by the beginning of the automobile, of aeroplanes, of cogs and turbines and wheels. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I love the strength that comes through in that look, which is why I actually have a Raymond Templier ring myself, which I think really sums up.
Is that Templier?
Well, I think it is. We say it is. Because all their marks in France at the time, they always marked everything on the outside, so it all gets worn off. But we're trying to see from the records that it is. So I like to think it is.
Yeah, it looks like it. I like that ring, too.
And I have there's a modern designer in London called Dominic Jones who's doing these very sort of edgy creations, and he works a lot with this girl, Alice Dalal, and the young Jagger girls, and he makes very sort of edgy, creative pieces. And he came to my office at Vogue and was so taken by this ring that he's done his own modern version, and he's called it the Carol Ring.
Oh, cool. So that's great. Good for you.
It's quite fun.
It is fun. Well, jewelry should be fun. I think, my experience with it is, I think people tend to be awed by it because of the value. But it should be something that gives joy, and to be too impressed by somebody's big diamonds is going the wrong way. That's really about your checkbook, not about your style or your taste.
Yeah, it was Chanel who said jewelry should. She said it was the sort of highest form of the highest form of wealth in a compressed form.
Yeah.
But a woman's décolletage shouldn't be a strong room. You shouldn't just have it there on show. It should be much more about your style and your personality and individuality, really.
It's really the only permanent art form that adorns the body, too. The fashion, the clothes don't last forever. And as you said,
yes.
it should last because, one, you spent so much money on it. But two, in the 30s, I know a lot of them, particularly like the Duchess of Windsor, she'd take something beautiful that was made in the 20s and redo it. And, this was this brilliant, brilliant piece of jewelry that had been... And so that all that design work was lost. Mm. They could afford to do it, too, but...
I was struck, actually, walking through the Met on Sunday morning, that some of, the 5th-century pieces you could actually have taken out of the showcases and just put them on.
Yeah.
They are... Some of this jewelry is as relevant now, it's as beautiful now, it tells all the... about that civilization, but you could still wear it.
Very easily, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially those spirally things that influenced Velperon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is that where her influence
A lot of it came from the Carolingian and all that. Mm-hmm. But also, there was one thing about her that intrigued me, is that towards the end of her life, one of the journalists was interviewing her, and she wasn't particularly forthcoming about anything. And they said, but tell us, why are you... You never signed your jewelry. You think of somebody that was as prolific as Suzanne Velperon, and she said, my style is my signature. which I think is one of the great lines of all times. And she was somewhat haughty, but she was accurate, too. Mm.
But then it's hard for people now to find her pieces.
Oh.
No signature to go on. And,
well, we have the drawing, so it makes it easier for us. We cheat.
Yeah. Hello. Yes, please.
Yeah, sure,
please.
Sure, please.
I'd be interested in knowing in selling jewelry how what you sell today differs from what you sold 20 years ago. For example, the clothing that we saw that bore those brooches, people don't really dress that way anymore. So I'm just curious as to how the sale of jewelry or the trends of jewelry have gone.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's harder to wear the big brooches because the material tends to be much lighter, although there are ways to back it from the back so that you can wear it on a lighter material. But I think what's changed really is that women buy jewelry for themselves. I mean, when I started in the 60s, I mean, most women would not go out and buy jewelry for themselves. Number one, women have more jewelry because they more money. I mean, they have money to because they have really good jobs, some of them. I mean, it's, and I don't think there's a stigma anymore about having. It was a time, I think, when a woman, if she had to buy her jewelry, it was like, oh, I'm sorry about that. You know, where you don't have a guy, what's wrong? But I think now it's. And also, I think too, there was that whole thing where if a man gave a woman a piece of jewelry, she didn't dare say she didn't like it because, I mean, there was the old-fashioned, oh, if you'd say that, he'll never give you anything again. I think now, I mean, what happens is a husband sometime, or boyfriend or whatever, will give a piece of jewelry, but with the understanding that if she doesn't like it, you know, they'll both go in and pick something that she does like. Or it's much more likely to happen than it was. I mean, I think, you know, all those 50s pictures of the women cooking at the stove in high heels and pearls, I think that's that's gone.
I also think the way jewelry is being sold is different, which isn't sort of in tune with what you're saying. There's so many fashion stores now. In London, David Street Market, Joseph, they all now have jewelry and they display it, fine, precious jewelry, alongside the clothes. So it's a different way of sort of mixing it all together.
Well, it's a teaching thing, too. Mm. I think also, traditionally, in the 50s and back, or 60s and back, that the people who bought jewelry grew up in families that had money, so that they learned about jewelry from their mothers or their grandmothers or aunts or whatever. Today, the people with a lot of money arrive out of nowhere. You know, they're wearing Birkenstock shoes and plaid shirts, and, you know, the guy makes, you know, $60 million, and they can't tell a diamond from a donut. And they don't know anything about style either. And I think the...
So that's where you come in, Ward.
No, but it's true. It's true. I mean, the families I dealt with back in the 60s, most of them were old money. And the old money's gone, you know. I mean, it really has changed. And the people who buy jewelry now aren't necessarily people who came from money. Mm. Mm.
So did you want to...
Yeah.
Mm. Ward.
Yeah, Ward. Yeah. Yes, pretty much so. I can tell. Yeah. I mean, if it's a low light and it's a dinner party and I've had two glasses of wine, it gets more difficult. But chances are you can tell. I mean, it's like nice tailoring on a suit. I mean, we're probably more attuned to it than the average person. But I mean, some of the things. Actually, Kenny Lane has made a copy of Belperron, the flower brooch,
yes,
and the earrings. You almost can't tell. I mean, it's that good. And his is, you know, $39.95, and the real thing's $150,000. So. But there are only one or two of the originals. But costume jewelry is wonderful. I love it. Excuse me.
You mentioned your museum. Is it in the city? Is it something we can...
I call it my museum collection. I used to show it in our gallery, and the problem was a couple would come in, and she'd fall in love with something, and then the husband would take me inside and say, that's what she wants. And I said, well, it's not for sale. So I'd end up with in a fight with them. They'd leave in angry, buying nothing. So I don't show it anymore except on special occasions. But we showed it for our 70th anniversary, and we're definitely going to bring it out for our 75th anniversary, which is in a couple of years. Yeah?
What do you think is the future? If you're saying that there's a lot of new money to move
Yeah. Well, that's my take on it.
Right. But when you're selling now, how do you convince people to appreciate, really appreciate the design
and
the basis?
Yeah. It's a good point, but I think that's Carol's world, really. I mean, in the sense of what looks well with what. You know, if you see something in the magazine and you see, I mean, the way you dress is something that, you know, a lot of young women, you know, who, I don't know, come in from the suburbs would like to know how to dress. They just don't know. I mean, you can tell right away.
Well, yeah, people look around and they get inspiration. They look at fashion magazines. But I think also, I think people learn their style pretty quick. I mean, if they don't know their diamonds from their donuts, they pretty soon begin to figure that out. And I think everybody wants something that has some rare factor. They look for something that somebody else doesn't have.
Yeah,
it's a good that's point. When it comes into sort of getting your own thing, commission, design, making it for you, and having something that I think jewelry often is a conversation piece, that people say, what is that? Why do you have it? There's always a story behind it, and I think people often use jewelry like that.
No, that's true. Also, everybody, I mean, I find that women, even today, one of the biggest things is they don't have enough time to spend putting it on, and everybody's got a different shaped face, so if you have a long face, you don't wear long earrings, or if you have a very round face, round earrings aren't the best idea. But a lot of people wouldn't know that necessarily. And if you have blue eyes, it's a very good idea to have blue or green earrings, because earrings tend to call attention to the eyes. There's a whole lot of little things that are, they're not really tricks, but I think women who spend a lot of time doing it know it. But I think, you know, we're also busy today, you know, and particularly women that work are busy. And you know, there's a tendency, like I know when someone inherits a necklace, like a pearl necklace or a bead necklace, it's almost always the wrong length, and it drives me wild. Well, you can tell if it was, you know, if she's tiny and the woman that she left it to her is big, it just looks dowdy. And it's just a matter of taking an inch or two out. You know, you just pull it up and look at it in the mirror and see how it looks. But little things like that. I mean, it's really like clothing. I mean, it should fit. And it should sit well on the body, and bracelets
and be, you know, comfortable. So
and comfortable, that's a key thing too. And you know, my son makes the joke about earrings. I won't try them on; he will. But but he said that, you know, it's true. If men wore earrings, they'd be a lot more comfortable. And it's true. I mean, women suffer in these things. I mean, my wife included. She'll say, "Oh God, I have to take them off; they hurt." And you think, I mean, I'm in the business. You'd think I could at least make them comfortable. But it's true.
Yes, it is. It's true.
I don't wear it. I just look at it.
And I think, you know, people discover their own style as they experiment. And I wrote this actually just before I came here for an English newspaper called The Evening Standard, who wanted me to write about what they thought Kate Middleton might be wearing. So at the moment, she's wearing very little.
Smart.
It's very sort of based around this sort of Kenyan designer who was born actually grew up about an hour from where Prince William proposed to Kate Middleton. So she's got all these sort of Kenyan influences from the local tribes there. But they're so little and you can hardly see what she's wearing. But I said, you know, hopefully in time she'll develop style and confidence, and then hopefully she might start commissioning modern designers to make things for her, because she's going to inherit all this really cumbersome, heavy jewelry which hasn't been changed for half a century. And it would be really nice, actually, if she reset some of them, you know, just recycled,
yeah,
took some of the stones, got a new designer, created something within her own style and look. So that's what I wrote.
Did you write it?
What will happen.
Did you write it for Vogue?
I wrote that for the Evening Standard.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for an informative and dazzling presentation. And it's now time to move over to the book sale table and for the autographs.